I'm Christopher Lydon. Inside the living labyrinth of literature that is the altogether amazing memory of Harold Bloom, the critic and teacher at Yale, we're at home with the great sage of New Haven on Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it, from the Watson Institute at Brown University. File this one with our poetry series, Whose Words These Are, though nothing compares really with visiting Harold Bloom, the only soul I know who can not only quote all of Shakespeare and Milton and the King James Version and the Hebrew Bible and Whitman and Dickinson, but loves also to perform the many thousands of lines in his head and link them all to their sources in each other. We narrowed the field just a little in this conversation by agreeing to center on a lifelong favorite of Harold Bloom's, the doomed and still difficult Jazz Age poet Hart Crane. Still beloved, still influential among American poets writing today. Harold, we've been talking to poets for a couple of months with the greatest sense of discovery, I must say, that there's so much activity, there's so much connection, there's so much invention, and maybe some very good poetry still being writ and talked about in the world. You know, we ask everybody sort of, who are the poets that gave them license or told them they must be poets? Wallace Stevens keeps coming up, but there's Hart Crane, too. I must say, a tough nut for me to crack over the many years. I know he's one of your favorites. I want to listen to you on Hart Crane as long as you'll talk to us.
He gives you an impacted density, you might say, and it's very difficult to unravel an impacted density. Crane is one of those rare poets who does not develop. He just unfolds. Mm. And as I say, the poetry that he's writing when he's 16 is already the kind of poetry that he will write when he kills himself at 32. You know, I fell in love with Crane's poetry, my God, more than 70 years ago. It was just past the age of 10. It was the early summer of 1940 that I started to read Hart Crane.
Where do you want to begin in a close Bloomian reading of some of these poems? Perhaps to Brooklyn Bridge? I know we want to talk about...
Crane really is a religious poet, but of an utterly new kind. And what, in fact, I have called the American religion, you know, of which Whitman is a prophet and Emerson is perhaps the greatest formulator in the essay Self-Reliance. But Crane is the ultimate dark celebrant of it because he had a tremendous yearning. He writes the whole of the bridge and writes the poem to Brooklyn Bridge, which is not the first part of the poem to be written, but he wanted it stationed at the start. It's a marvelous lyric at every point.
Would you walk us through it, Harold?
Well, it begins, Crane is on the Brooklyn side of the bridge. You know, he had actually moved into a one-room apartment overlooking the bridge. And he used to spend a lot of time with his close friend, with whom I used to discuss Crane endlessly, because the great photographer Walker Evans wound up here at Yale teaching photography. Walker is dead now, but he had been very close to Crane. They were not lovers, but they were very close personal friends. And his marvelous photographs of Brooklyn Bridge are deeply influenced by Crane, just as Crane's The Bridge as a poem is deeply influenced by Walker Evans's photographs of the bridge. Crane discovered, only after he had conceived of the bridge and started writing it, that the little one-room apartment in which he was living had been occupied by the Roeblings, father and son, just as a workroom when they were overseeing the actual construction of the bridge. It is a great work of art, Brooklyn Bridge, as anyone. You have just got to walk it now or just stand on the Brooklyn side of it, stand on the promenade there and look at it across the harbor, as Crane says. So it's dawn, and the poem begins magnificently with the image of a seagull, which has been sleeping on the water all night. how many dawns chill from his rippling rest, the seagull's wings shall dip and pivot him out over the harbor, building high over the chained bay waters, liberty. And there's everything that he actually describes is something that he sees, but he sees it from a perspective that no one else, I believe, has ever seen it or could see it without him. Switch to close to the end of the poem. Go down there, dear. O harp and altar of the fury fused, suddenly the bridge stands up there between shores, and as the wind hits it, a music is coming from it. It is both an altar to the unknown God, and it is the harp in which the hymn of his poem is being composed, of the fury fused, and then the beautiful parenthetical question, how could mere toil, directed by the Roeblings, of course, align thy quiring strings? And then, terrific threshold of the prophet's pledge, and then comes prayer of pariah, the outcast figure like Crane, and the lover's cry. Ultimately behind it is the 137th Psalm, If I Forget Thee, O Jerusalem, by the rivers of Babylon, we sat down and wept. Yea, we wept. This is King James. We wept when we remembered Zion. We hanged our harps upon the willows in the midst thereof. That's the origin of the great high romantic European image of the Aeolian harp, the wind harp. As Crane knew, and he also, I think, intuited that the origin of it was in the 137th Psalm, and then lines that I fell desperately in love with as a child and can never get out of my head. Again, the traffic lights, see the at night, that skim thy swift, unfractioned idiom. And then a wonderful Blakean trope, immaculate sigh of stars, beating thy path, condense eternity. And then a great line, one of the greatest lines ever written in anybody's poetry, and we have seen night lifted in thine arms. And every time Gene and I are driven into New York, especially if it's at night on the West Side Drive, and of course you're not looking at Brooklyn Bridge, but you're looking at that very impressive George Washington Bridge, visualize what Crane is writing. Lines beyond praise. Under thy shadow, by the piers I waited, only in darkness is thy shadow clear. And then, probably the greatest trope even in Crane, the city's fiery apostles all undone. Think of what that is, Chris, dear. What Crane gives you, you're now at towards the end of the poem, you've gone through a whole day of watching the Manhattan. The skyscrapers, and it's December, so he has Christmas on his mind. The skyscrapers, lights are coming on. And he describes this because think of someone, you're unwrapping a Christmas present, okay? And it has jagged edges, of course. If they were on fire, then he's saying that the skyscrapers, the lights coming on at night there on the Manhattan lower shore, are the city's fiery apostles all undone.
Okay.
But of course, the city's fiery apostles is a terrifying vision. The gifts that a city gives you are indeed on fire and burn your hand. And then the switching to the other extreme, very grim, already snow submerges an iron year, which is quite marvelous. O sleepless as the river under thee, vaulting the sea, the prairie's dreaming sod. Notice the bridge suddenly goes both directions. One across the country to the Pacific, the other out over the Atlantic, a visionary bridge binding the world together, as in the prophecy of Isaiah, that the riven halves will yet be brought together again. O sleepless as the river under thee, vaulting the sea, the prairies dreaming sod, unto us lowliest, sometime sweep, descend. And all through the poem, he's emphasized the sweep of the bridge, the vaulting, that magnificent, agile leap that Roebling conceived and built into the architecture of the bridge, that marvelous leaping effect, which is still unmatched, the sort of wonderful sculpture of it, because that's what the Brooklyn Bridge is. It's a great, tremendous, enormous sculpture. Unto us lowliest, sometimes sweep, descend, and that marvelous line, and of the curve ship, lend a miff to God who badly needs one, who's out of miffs, who is derelict. Lend a miff to God. Give it to him on loan. So the poem ends in a kind of exalted pathos in which that beautiful, hopeful opening of the gull breaking the water and rising up and sweeping like the Statue of Liberty itself out over the harbor. Nevertheless, they are the chained bay waters, and this is a Blakean vision, therefore, of being locked into nature and not escaping yet into the imagination, or a visionary way of surmounting the limitations of nature. And though those closing stanzas have a kind of wonderful upward movement, as though you would pierce through in transcendence and indeed make a myth, a story, a word that you could then present to a God who badly needs it, who's not only unknown but mostly forgotten, the imagery is endlessly dark, particularly in the very great trope, the city's fiery apostles all undone. In a strange way, he echoes that in the death poem.
Would you speak of that?
The Broken Tower.
Please.
It could be Crane's greatest poem, much as one loves so much more of the poetry.
The Broken Tower begins with God, as Brooklyn Bridge ends with God.
A very special, well, this is the unknown God, but this is the vacated, look, here's Crane goes to Mexico, but he plunges into a desperate year of endless drinking, of violence, of inability to read or write very much at all. Only a handful of lines come out of the year. But in desperation towards the close, partly moved by the one heterosexual relationship of his life, Crane hears, he wakes up one morning and the cathedral bells are ringing, and it produces, the cathedrals are empty. This is still the Mexican Revolutionary Government and all the cathedrals are closed. But there are sextons who do ring the bells and caretakers. And Crane was fascinated by this image of a cathedral with the bells going. And the imagery comes to him from a variety of sources. As always, he is immensely erudite and gathers together exactly the right sources. One is a passage that I think must have haunted him all his life. In Yeats's great prose reverie, Per Amica Silentia Lunae, that is to say, in the friendly silence of the moon, a Virgilian tag, occurs a sentence which has haunted me all my life. This is all one sentence. I shall find the dark grow luminous, the void fruitful, when I understand that I have nothing, that the ringers in the tower have appointed for the hymen, H-Y-M-E-N, that is to say, the marriage song of the soul, a passing bell. Let me repeat that. I shall find the dark grow luminous, the void fruitful, when I understand that I have nothing, that the ringers in the tower have appointed for the hymen of the soul, a passing bell, meaning that no one really marries anyone else. Or as Yeats said in another context, the tragedy of sexual intercourse is the perpetual virginity of the soul. Very Yeatsian indeed. I don't think Crane had ever encountered that sentence, but he had certainly read Per Amica Silentia Lunae, and he remembered that tremendous, long, beautiful sentence. And of course, as you intimated earlier, he is returning to the poem to Brooklyn Bridge. He is returning to the imagery of all of his poetry. But the opening is incredibly powerful. The bell rope that gathers God at dawn. You know, the sexton is ringing it. But you're not summoning worshipers because the cathedrals and churches are closed. There are no priests. They've all been extirpated. The bell rope that gathers God at dawn dispatches me, finishes me off, as though I dropped down the knell of a spent day. And then quite horrifyingly, to wander the cathedral lawn from pit to crucifix, the pit of hell to the crucifix, feet chill on steps from hell. And then that great series, have you not heard, have you not seen that core of shadows in the tower whose shoulders sway, antiphonal carillons launched before the stars are caught and hived in the sun's ray, which, by the way, comes out of the opening of Shelley's The Triumph of Life, where the stars are, in effect, being destroyed by the light of nature, the light of the sun. The poets are being eclipsed. And then the incredible power that Crane summons. The bells, and that wonderful I say, the bells, I say, the bells break down their tower and swing I know not where. And it's very clear what he's doing. The bells are the poetic gift in Crane. The tower is not just his body, but his entire consciousness. It is everything that Hart Crane means. And the poetic gift is murdering him. It's too strong for him. Mm. He's never been able to properly live with it or house it. And swing I know not where. And then very frightening line, their tongues engrave membrane through marrow. And then brilliant phrase, bringing together the homosexual idiom of scoring and these different encounters, all these sailors and so on, with a musical score. Their tongues engrave membrane through marrow, and then speaking of his entire poetry as well as his life, my long scattered score of broken intervals. Mm-hmm. Now, you can diminish or lengthen an interval. You can have a diminished second or a diminished fourth. Yes. And then oval encyclicals and canyons heaping the impasse high with choir, banked voices, slain pagodas, campaniles with reveille's outleaping, and then, oh, terraced echoes prostrate on the plain. And he's talking about the condition of his poetry, these sort of gorgeous structures now thrown away. And so it was I entered the broken world, which is the Gnostic myth, to trace the visionary company of love, its voice an instant in the wind, but not for long to hold each desperate choice, and then crying out, my word I poured, but was it cognate, scored by that tribunal monarch of the air? The tribunal monarch of the air is Apollo, as in the myth of Apollo, but it's also what the revelation of John does to it, making it into the devil, Apollon. That is to say, scored by the devil, whose thigh embronzes earth, and then strikes the crystal word, which has to be the word of Christ, the terrible crystal in Pater's formulation of it, in wounds, they have to be the wounds of Jesus, pledged once to hope, cleft to despair. And then the steep encroachments of my blood left me no answer. And he works his way. Suddenly he realizes and makes you realize, and you hadn't known that earlier in the poem, he's lying by the side of his sleeping heterosexual lover, Peggy Beard. And as he listens to her breath and feels her heartbeat. He suddenly realizes that what really moves him in her is not woman as such, but just the sheer sense of mortality. And out of that, he gives you that extraordinary climax of the poem in which the directions of upwards and downwards are reversed, and the male and the female are mingled together. But it's a resolution that he wants to believe in, but you can see even from the diction itself how tentative it is, how very, very tentative it is. Read that aloud.
What I hold healed,
original now and pure,
and builds within
a tower that is not stone.
Not stone can jacket heaven.
Yes.
But slip of pebbles.
Yes.
Visible
but,
wings.
But the slip
silent.
Means the making of a ceramic. Go on.
Visible wings of silence sown in azure circles,
widening
yes. as they dip the matrix of the heart. Lift down the eye that shrines the quiet lake and swells a tower, the commodious, tall decorum
of that sky
unseals
her earth and lifts love in its shower. But there's a reversal of the male and female images there. There's a reversal of the role of earth and heaven. He's following very closely a trope in Dante's Paradiso. But it's wistful. The tone of it, unlike the sort of powerful strokes of earlier in the poem, which are so clairvoyantly persuasive, the tone is very gentle, it's very moving, but he's not persuaded. And he came to believe for that reason that the poem was a failure, which it certainly is not. And that may have been an element in the suicide, I don't know. It's very hard to say.
Harold, can I say it's a very moving thing to hear you unfold these poems out of your head without a note to make the connections with Melville and Yeats and the King James edition and Stevens and all of them. Is it a
There is, in fact, an echo, deliberate echo on his part in the closing two stanzas of the close of Sunday Morning in Harmonium. By Stevens.
I was going to say the dip of the extended wings.
Yes, it's the image of the downward to darkness on yes. extended wings. And it's an homage on his part, very deliberate, to Wallace Stevens.
Widening as they dip the matrix of the heart.
Yeah, that's very. But he's punning on his own name, heart, as he frequently does. H A R T, H E A R T.
I marvel at your performance of this stuff, but I also wonder, is this not the perfect illustration of what you mean by the living labyrinth, of an endless exchange?
Many years ago, I wrote a review of something by Borges, and I talked about the fact that his very first story of his characteristic kind, Pierre Menard, author of The Quixote, shows a kind of deep weariness on the part of Borges as he enters the living labyrinth of literature.
What if you are the living labyrinth, Harold?
Don't be silly.
No, I mean
it's a nice trope, my boy. Borges was a kind of living labyrinth of literature, yes.
I never get to meet Borges, but I've never met anybody who could connect the dots the way you do.
There's a wonderful play which I first found out about the one time I ever met Tennessee Williams. He'd invited me to come see him in his hotel suite in New York. And he handed me the old edition of the Collected Poems of Hart Crane, you know, a book which I knew very well because it was the first book I ever owned. My oldest sister, at my request, gave it to me for a 12th birthday present after I'd been in love with the poetry for 2 years already. And I'd copied out all the poems by hand anyway, as I'd copied out Blake's long poems before eventually I acquired a complete Blake. Williams totally identified with Hart Crane. The major influence on Williams's plays its total with his poems, which are ruined by the effect of Crane on them. But the influence on his plays always being cited. The titles of several of them, like Summer and Smoke and Suddenly Last Summer, are taken from Crane. The epigraph to his best play, A Streetcar Named Desire, it's the great stanza from the Broken Tower. And so it was I entered the broken world to trace the visionary company of love. Its voice an instant in the wind, I know not whither hurled, but not for long to hold each desperate choice, which is a description by Crane of his erotic career. Williams handed me the book and said he never went anywhere without it and it was going to be buried with him someday. I said, buried with you? He said, my will specifies, Professor Bloom, that my corpse be sewn up in a white shroud with this book, and it's to be thrown into the Caribbean at the exact spot where he leaped off the SS Oris Baza. In fact, they didn't honor that part of the will. The book is now returned, because I'll never forget my delight in this. I picked up the book, opened it, and it plainly said, copy of the Washington University of St. Louis Library. I looked at him. I said, Mr. Williams, you stole this book. He said proudly, he said, Harold, he said, switching to my first name, he said, look at the date of acquisition. And I saw that they had acquired it soon after it was published in 1933 or so. I said, yes, he said. And look when it was first taken out. I said, yes, it's only been taken out once. He said, that was me, many years after they acquired it. And after I left them after less than a year as their student, I felt naturally, since no one in the world could love the book, at least maybe till you came along as much as I did, it was mine.
Does it help to understand Hart Crane to recall the letter he sent to Alan Tate in which he said, let us invent an idiom for the proper transposition of jazz into words.
Yes.
Something clean, sparkling, elusive.
Yes, and then he picks that up himself in his wonderful poem, Faustus and Helen, where he uses the jazz idiom to write a jazz section of the poem in rather remarkable rhythms. But I finally had the satisfaction of introducing my favorite jazz man, Bud Powell, to Hart Crane, because I felt there was deep affinity. I gave him a copy of the collected poems of Hart Crane, and he read it. And we discussed The Broken Tower, and I told him how much his Un Poco Loco, especially in that great three-take recording of it. I heard him play Un Poco Loco, but just one take. But
there's Max Roach on the cowbell.
Max on the percussion, including that. And Curly Russell, great bass player. Just the three of them.
Harold,
but that is one of the monuments of jazz, Un Poco Loco, particularly with all three versions. The way it builds and accumulates it. And I love the way, at the end of the second version, you can hear on the old Blue Note recording, Powell's voice huskily saying, one more. He didn't like it the first time. He didn't like the second take. But the third take, you just feel, as in The Broken Tower, that everything is breaking apart. You know, that the mind has reached its limits and there's nothing for it to do but disintegrate. That the bells are breaking down their tower, as I think Powell's gift was too great for Powell.
Harold Bloom, I cannot thank you
never
enough.
Never mind. I love you madly, as you know.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Harold Bloom. Ben Mandelkern recorded it. Post up on the poetry that haunts your head, on the jazz connection perhaps, on the bells in your tower that Hart Crane and Harold Bloom set ringing. Leave a comment at our website, radioopensource.org. And thank you for joining the conversation. I'm Christopher Lydon.